then tell me, Sean O'Farrell, tell me why you hurry so. Hush your vocal, hush and listen, and his cheeks were all aglow. I bear orders from the captain, get you ready quick and soon, for the pikes must be together by the rising of the moon. By the rising of the moon, by the rising of the moon, for the pikes must be together by the rising of the moon. Oh, then tell me, Sean O'Farrell, where the gathering is to be, in the old spot by the river, right well known to you and me. One more roar for signal token, whistle up the marching tune, for your pike upon your shoulder by the rising of the moon. By the rising of the moon, by the rising of the moon, with your pike upon your shoulder by the rising of the moon. Out from many a mud walled cabin eyes were watching through the night, many a manly chest was throbbing for the blessed warning light. Farmers passed along the valleys like the man she's lonely crew, and the thousand blades were flashing at the rising of the moon. At the rising of the moon, at the rising of the moon.
Greetings from the Northwest Homeland, comrades. It's September the 10th, 2015. I'm Harold Covington, and this is Radio Free Northwest.
Hello, comrades. My name is Lacey, and this is my first audio file, and I hope that this will be the first of many to come. I have never actually thought of doing one until last week's podcast. A young man did a quick audio file. He expressed a reluctance to migrate because he felt alone or that there wasn't a large number of people making the move, and I wanted to reach out to him and other comrades like him listening. My husband and I have been interested in the NWF for a couple of years. We've read all the novels, but to be honest, it was just a far-off idea that we batted around, and it never was a serious venture. Until the last year, which was the birth of our first child. So, comrades, now it's game time. Now it's serious. And it's not just about us anymore. It's about an innocent young child. A white child that deserves better than this. His future brother and sisters deserve better than this. The this that I speak of is an East Coast city. It's overrun with drug, murderers, rapists, homeless, and just all around undesirables. And that's the norm now. And we assume that this was the case for the entire United States. Fortunately, we had discovered the NWF and decided that this will be the safest place for us to go, the safest place to raise children. We've lived here our entire lives. We have very, very deep roots that need to be dug up. Our plan is to migrate in the next 7 to 8 months. This plan gives us enough time to liquidate our assets that can't be taken with us, arrange employment, housing, and I just want to assure the comrades listening, you are not alone. This thing is happening, and any excuse that you have or reason that you have for not packing the moving van, comrades, it's just not enough. We are speaking here of the physical extinction of our race. And we're not speaking of hundreds of years from now. We're talking now. It's happening. And the only viable solution that I have seen is the Northwest Front. We're going, and you should too. We've already started sending resumes and making arrangements. And as it gets closer and closer, hopefully I'll be able to update you to our status. I hope that this shows you that you are not the only one. There are many like us. And it's senseless to be spread so thin. We need to be together, together so that we can start to do something to assure a safe place for our children and our children's children. Comrades, don't be selfish. It's not just about you. There is so much more at stake here, and it cannot be done from behind a computer. Start making the plan of migration as we are. So until next time, comrades, take care, stay safe. And hopefully we will talk again soon.
Okay, that's a good way to kick off the first segment of the show this week, which will deal with, surprise, surprise, the subject of Northwest migration. Bet you didn't see that coming, did you? Over the weekend, we met with Matt from California and his wife, you know, the young man that we had on the show last week. Now, all through the past 3 months, we have had an absolutely brilliant summer here in the Olympic Peninsula. Sunshine virtually every day, and so now on Labor Day weekend, when we have this young potential migrant couple coming up on their scouting trip, needless to say, that's when the cloud cover drops down and we get the first couple of days of gray. And of course, the minute they go back to California, the sun will come out and shine for another 3 weeks. September up here can usually be considered a summer month. Now, moving along with migration studies here, I'm going to talk about some things now that may seem a bit counterintuitive, but I have to be completely honest here. I need to shoot straight with you folks who are seriously planning your homecoming because you need complete and up-to-date information on which to base your decisions. Just about every week, I get emails from white people who are seriously considering migration, and they constantly ask me, "But where, Harold, where do you recommend we go? Can we come out there and move in next door to you?" Well, that's kind of what Northwest migration was for many years, i.e. get on a Greyhound bus to Hayden Lake, Idaho, and move into Pastor Butler's bunkhouse and raid the refrigerator. Now, this situation that the Northwest Front is trying to create is much more complex. We're serious about it, and you guys deserve the straight dish on things. Now, many of you who begin your migration process come here to the Puget Sound area first because you want to meet me and also because in many cases you require access to the kind of jobs which are available only in a major urban area. Not so much Portland, not yet anyway, because although we have people in Portland, we don't have anybody who's in a position to act as a unit leader down there and who can deal with scouting trips and new migrants. I hope that will change soon. Now, that's a note for all you young men who think you have what it takes to be the Northwest's George Lincoln Rockwell. Portland and the entire state of Oregon is wide open. Go to it. I get that you guys want to come here and see the elephant, so to speak. You're all welcome, and we look forward to settling in many of you as new neighbors and members of our little community we've got growing here. But in all honesty and fairness, I have to make a few observations about the Puget area in general and the area I live in particular. Now, for the record, by Pugetopolis, I don't just mean the city of Seattle itself. I mean this whole long string of cities and towns and exurbs and whatnot that runs up and down the east side of the Puget Sound, roughly from Olympia in the south all the way up to Bellingham on the Canadian border. Although, of course, Seattle kind of holds central pride of place in this long strip of overdeveloped real estate. The fact is that things have changed somewhat here just in the few years since I came up from Astoria, Oregon. I have to concede that in some respects, the racial and demographic and economic situation has deteriorated in parts of this area, specifically in the city of Seattle itself, in the city of Tacoma, and in a small part of Kitsap County over here on the western side of the Puget Sound, which is clustered around and economically dependent on the Naval Shipyard and other Navy facilities, which I probably shouldn't even mention because NCIS and Naval Intelligence listens to this podcast, as I know from the stat counter, which shows me where the hits come from, and I don't want them to get so raving paranoid that they send the arthritic agent Leroy Gibbs after me. By the way, that has got to be one of the most stupid and lame series on TV. Has anyone noticed that Mark Harmon is older than I am? He needs to be doing denture cream ads. Why in God's name is he still playing a romantic lead? Sorry, where was I? Okay, I'm just going to lay this on you straight. Prospective new migrants are running into some problems here in the Puget area and especially in Seattle itself, along with certain near suburbs. What has happened is that over the past 3 years or so, the word has gotten out about Seattle, i.e. that it is one of the few places in the country where there are still jobs available in any quantity and quality, and one of the few remaining places in America where there is still some tattered remnant of the old prosperity. There are still high-paying major employers here, the old standbys of Boeing and Microsoft, although Boeing has been quietly downsizing its operation for a long time, and I suspect at some point they're going to flee the city completely if they ever lose their sweetheart tax breaks from the state and those lefty unions keep messing with them. Plus, we now have Amazon here, and we're expecting to get our books and liquor and pizzas delivered by Jeff Bezos's drones sometime in the near future. There are tech and IT companies out the wazoo, most of whom nobody outside the industry has ever heard of, but which generate billions of dollars in revenues every year, and of course a massive military presence through the Joint Base Lewis-McChord outside Tacoma, and the extensive Navy stuff from Everett on down through Bangor and Bremerton and the Sound area, everything from nuclear submarines to aircraft carriers. Now right now there is a major carrier that put in here last February for an 18-month refit, and that's spewing out the dollars into the community by the millions in various ways. And, of course, drawing all kinds of people in all trades and colors and rackets to the area who are descending on the western Kitsap shore looking to slurp up some of that military money from machinists and carpenters to marine engineers to hookers and dope peddlers and used car salesmen. But it's temporary. Come a year from now, that carrier will be gone, and it may be a couple more years before something else that big sails in to act as a honeypot for all those newcomers and bring all those transients back. But right now, they are really jamming up the area, and they're snapping up rental housing right, left, and center, and driving rents up. Now, the result is that at this point in time, everybody and his dog is moving to Seattle. We have our migration, all right, and many of them are white people migrating for a combination of both economic and racial reasons, even though they don't even know that the Northwest Front exists. We call them organic migrants. Now, these people will one day make valuable citizens of the Northwest Republic. But there are also a lot of undesirables coming up here for the same economic reasons. They're following the money, and especially over here on this side of the water, it's becoming noticeable. Now, in addition to all the other incentives, the left-wing Seattle City Council recently passed one of these stupid $15 per hour minimum wage laws, and we have a whole stream of pilgrims of people of all shapes, sizes, and colors, poor people, who are coming here seriously expecting that they are going to be paid $15 an hour to flip burgers in Mickey D's. Now, in actual practice, that's not happening, of course. What's happening is that most restaurants and other minimum wage employing businesses are closing up and moving out of the city to the suburbs to get away from that stupid law. And all of the people who have come here to flip burgers are going to end up flipping them or pushing broom in Everett or Kent or Bellevue or someplace, and so snapping up what little affordable housing remains and pushing up the rents in those areas. Now, the result of all this, and I have to be straight with you guys about this, is that while there are still jobs here, in a way, that's become a problem and a drawback because rental housing has become tight and very expensive in this area. And if you are in a position to buy, which is very rare for a white man or family these days, house prices are going to be pretty steep because we've got the jobs here. We've got too many people flooding in, and housing is a seller's market. Now, it's an old Northwest equation we've run into time and again since I came up here 13 years ago. Rent is in inverse proportion to the distance from your place of employment. You can still get affordable housing out here in the peninsula and in the far ring burbs of Seattle. Sure, tons of it. But in the Puget area, chances are it will be 40 or 50 miles from your job. And so one of the things you're going to have to factor in is the need for a reliable motor vehicle and the expense and wear and tear of commuting. Not to mention having to navigate what have to be some of the most atrocious freeways in the world. Everybody bitches about L.A., but I wouldn't wish Seattle traffic on my worst enemy. I just simply refuse to drive over there. Now, this does not mean that you cannot find a wonderful new life for yourself and your family here in Puget Land. It just means that as much as possible you avoid the city itself and certain rather sleazed out suburbs and exurbs, which wasn't really necessary 20 years ago when I first came here. At that time, Seattle was a much, much nicer place, but the slow degeneration of American life into a cesspit is happening here just like everywhere else. One of the reasons we need to begin the process of putting a stop to it. Choosing the Pugetopolis might still be the right fit for you and your family, but it means that you need to plan with extra special care, that you need to bring as much money as you can with you when you come, and that you need to bust your butt to get some kind of job or job offer beforehand so that you can list an employer and an income on a rental application. If you can't do either, usually a landlord's jitters can be soothed by a large roll of cash for deposits and whatnot. Now, it's been customary in the past for landlords to demand both first and last month's rent as well as a deposit. They call it cleaning deposit, security deposit, whatever. I gather that's seldom the case in practice these days, basically because with 95 million adults not in the workplace, thanks to Barack Obama, Landlords are more used to dealing with the jobless, and they know that so few people have that kind of money on hand, even in savings anymore. But like I said, you need to bring as big a bankroll with you as you can. Now, I'm mentioning all this so we don't get any of you coming up here and claiming that you were deceived or bamboozled in any way beforehand. You need to understand that, yes, you are going to see niggers and beaners and hoppas on the street up here, at least in the urban areas, and that you are going to see more of them than you would have seen 21 years ago in 1994 when I first lived in Seattle, and that you are going to see more of them even than you would have in 2009 when I first arrived here in the peninsula. Now, that is because, as I said, Seattle, and to a lesser extent Portland, are among the few remaining parts of the empire outside Washington, D.C. itself where there are any readily available jobs, and therefore everybody and his dog wants to come here. And they are coming here. And they are running up the cost of affordable housing and certain other stuff accordingly. Not to mention messing up the racial demographics in the urban areas themselves. Now, I say to you again, the good life is still available to you and your family in some picture postcard little Twin Peaks-style northwest town. But you will need to have a trade or a skill that allows you to make a living in a small town without big business and money of the kind that attracts racial detritus. If you don't have that, if you are dependent on getting and keeping some kind of corporate paycheck, then you're going to have to put up with an increasing amount of the filth that other city dwellers have to put up with, and this is our fault. We started this way too late, and we are moving forward way too slow. And soaring housing costs for new migrants are just one of the adverse effects of that. By the way, I found out who does all the evil karaoke. It's someone using the name Murakiyu on YouTube, and he also calls himself occasionally Aryan Troll. Still no idea who he is, but he does a lot of really, really good stuff, and I hope he can stick around and keep on churning it out.
God, I love America. I just want America to succeed. Support the troops. When all my savings are gone, thanks to the Federal Reserve's plan, I'll have to start again. I'll send my kid to the state-run camps. I'll thank my lucky stars for the taxes I still pay. Because if I resisted, they'd take my life away. And I'm proud to be an American, 'cause we're a little bit more free. And I thank the men who died in wars to prop up our currency. And I fetishize the Constitution, but the state is not constrained. And I worship paper and the flag, just like I was trained. From the infantile Democrats to the mercantilist GOP, across Iraq and Afghanistan, to our commanders in Galilee, from the AMA to AIPAC, the lawyers and AARP. When someone says their life won't start, it must be because they're lazy. Yeah. Proud to be an American, where gov is half of GDP. And I thank the men who died in wars to prop up our currency. And I fetishize the Constitution, but the state is not constrained. And I worship paper and the flag, just like I was trained.
evening, comrades. Tonight we'll be discussing my 6th edition of Arthur Kemp's March of the Titans. Now, I'm going to entitle this discussion Race Wars in the Americas, because really this is going to be about placement and dominance. Now, we see this with the Amerinds and also with Haiti. One of the earliest clashes of society was King Philip's War in the 1670s, and it is credited with helping to create Euro-American identity. As a result of that difficulty and others like it, the British ordered white settlement to be restricted to the East Coast. During the American Revolution, some of the larger tribes sided with the British. And with this in mind, the framers of the Constitution classed Indians as foreign nationals. After the Revolution, the Trade and Intercourse Act was passed to keep Indians from being defrauded. Now, over time, some criticized Indian fighters like Andrew Jackson. However, by the 1850s, many of the tribes were being moved west and set up on reservations. This was especially true as a result of the 1849 gold rush. Now, back in around the 1850s, there were some tribes that began something called the Ghost Dance. And this was a religious movement that was oriented towards resistance. Now, this led to the Battle of Bighorn and Wounded Knee. Now, in 1924, Indians were given citizenship, and the Bureau of Indian Affairs maintains a kind of diplomacy between sovereign states. Now, around this time, you also had John Bidwell and the Western Immigration Society and the ideology of manifest destiny. Now, this would lead whites to California and Oregon. By the 1830s, you started having clashes with the Mexicans, and they wanted to tax white immigrants that would come into their territory. Now, this would eventually lead to the Alamo and also a war over California. Eventually, Mexico would lose a lot of territory to the U.S. Back to the subject of slavery, everywhere it was found that the Amerinds would not work as slaves. And so this brought in a lot of the replacement that we see, especially in the islands. One interesting example is that of Haiti. In 1789, you had the western part of the San Domingo Island that was then called San Dominique. That portion of the island produced more sugar, coffee, and cotton than all the other North American colonies. Now, in the 1790s, you had a group in France called Friends of the Blacks, and they really wanted to get the vote for mulattoes and free blacks of Haiti. Now, there were many reversals on this. In a very short amount of time, they got the blacks really whipped up, and the Haitians decided on a revolution. Now, the French tried to recapture the islands, but they were pushed back by a yellow fever outbreak, and most whites and mulattoes on the island were killed off. Now, Haiti is only 35 years younger than the U.S., and it is desperately poor as a result of gaining independence and trying to govern itself. Now, back to North America. Technically, in North America, slaves did have some legal rights. They had support in sickness, they could get religious instruction, and also they could bring lawsuits. Now, in theory, this rarely happened because the slaves were illiterate. They didn't have the ability to be educated. Another thing that tended to happen was that, as with the Indians, a lot of blacks tended to support the British. During the Revolutionary War, some groups of blacks were actually evacuated by British troops into places like Nova Scotia. During the Constitutional Convention, there was an argument between North and South as to whether blacks would be counted. And actually, the South wanted the blacks to be counted for purposes of the Electoral College. Now, this ends up with the 3/5 compromise. And in 1857, you have the Dred Scott decision that decided that slaves were not citizens. Now, as early as 1787, some blacks were repatriated to Sierra Leone. And also, you had the American Colonization Society, which was spearheaded by James Monroe, that established Liberia in 1822. So even though Lincoln never got to repatriate the slaves, you still had some repatriation even prior to what Lincoln wanted to do. Now, by the end of the 18th century, all the states north of Maryland barred slavery and laws favored containment. Kansas would become a state of anti- and pro-slavery turmoil, and this is where you get John Brown. Now, in 1859, the South knew that the North had the upper hand, and there were legal arguments for and against secession, but they were inconclusive. By February of 1861, the South had set up a provisional government, and the Union said that while it would not interfere with slave states, states did not have the right to leave the Union. Now, Bull Run ends up ending well for the Confederates, and the North realizes that it's in for a long haul. But as early as 1861, you have General Sherman who seizes Port Royal as part of the Anaconda Plan, which was a desire to strangle the South in a naval sense. Then also you have James Mason, who understood that the South needed its own navy, so they persuaded the British to build ships for the Confederacy. But in 1862, you have Grant, who opened a sea route into Tennessee, and you had the Battle of Murfreesboro, which was inconclusive. But afterwards, the Confederates were fighting a rear action. In 1863, you have the fall of Vicksburg, and that really split the South in half. While there are many examples of the Confederates fighting very bravely, such as at Pickett's Charge, the South could not take the heavy losses. Now, the North didn't like all the heavy losses either, and there would be riots in the North over conscription when that started. But at any rate, the South really bore the brunt of it because of its smaller population. Now, eventually, you would have the sinking of the CSS Alabama off the coast of France, which goes to show that the Southern Navy was actually somewhat more global, actually, and even had ships in the Pacific. But at any rate, Sherman ended up following a scorched earth policy, and the various freed slaves would take vengeance on their former masters. Now, amazingly, the Confederacy held out until May of 1865. And one thing that you could give Sherman credit for was that he did attempt to give the islands off Carolina and Georgia to the blacks. So he wanted to segregate the blacks, but various Reconstruction Acts overrode the Dred Scott decision, and the Confederates, or former Confederates, were given limited citizenship rights. And this was cemented by the Ironclad Oath, which talked about anyone who had taken up arms against the Union. Now, a military government was set up. Southerners ended up having to pay compensation for the war. In 1865, you had the original Klan set up with Forrest and Gordon. It helped to overturn Reconstruction. This was done with a mixture of political activity and vigilante violence. Now, the Klan was so active that President Grant would pass the Civil Rights Act. But the situation improved when you had a new generation of Southern Democrats who were termed the Redeemers, when they became old enough to vote, and also with the election of Rutherford B. Hayes, who would withdraw the troops. So in the 1920s, at the premiere of Birth of a Nation, Woodrow Wilson would actually declare that the original 1865 Klan of Forrest and Gordon ended up saving Southern culture. So I've had a lot to go over in this talk. I've tried to be as brief as possible while capturing a lot of key points, especially dealing with Civil War, which I always find fascinating, and also the example of Haiti. So I hope you enjoyed this discussion, and I thank you very much for listening, and hail victory, comrades.
Greetings, comrades. This is the trucker coming at you from the edge of the homeland. Just left Rocker, Montana, with a load going over to Pennsylvania, doing a truck recovery. Not that that really means that much to you, just the company had to pull a driver out of a truck, and I got to bring it back to the yard. So the wife's driving ahead of me, and right now I'm trucking across Montana, headed eastbound. And for you, those of you either planning a scouting trip here, road trip here shortly, or your migration, it's cooling off here in Montana. It's currently 46 degrees and on September 4th, Friday morning, about, 8, 9 o'clock, I guess it is here. And there's snow up there on the hilltops. Yep. Winter's coming to old man winter is here, getting here to Montana. So just be aware of that. They're wrapping up their road construction because they'll probably only have maybe this month before the snow starts flying hot and heavy, either in October or maybe as late as November, but it definitely starts cooling off. It's rainy, it's cloudy, it's putting out the fires. That's a good thing, because it's been the wildfires out here in the homeland have been pretty severe this past summer coming into Montana. Over there in the western part of Montana, going past an airfield, they had 4 or 5 of the helicopters in there, Chinook and a Siskiyou Sky Crane and a couple other helicopters. I think one of them was a Huey, and I'm not sure what the other one or two were, but yeah, they were on the ground and taking a break, I guess, doing maintenance on them probably, because they didn't have to go and be bombing the wildfires with water and all that. I'm sure everybody was taking a well-deserved break from their firefighting duties. So anyway, I just thought I'd go and touch base with y'all and go and give a little bit of weather update for out here. It's nice and green. Like I said, cooled off here in this part of the homeland. Like I say, it's going to probably gonna get white here in the next month or two. I've seen it snow as early as I've seen them shut I-80 down because of blizzards in September, about mid to late September, down in Wyoming. Haven't really had any of those problems up here in Montana, but Colorado requires us commercial truck drivers to carry chains from, I think it's September 1st through, I think May 1st, I think it was. I think that's what it was, because they definitely, on certain sections, one section of I-7, snow, or the possibility of snow. So, yeah, if you're from back east and you think I'm BSing about this, well, make a move out here to the homeland. You see that I'm not yanking your chain or anything like that. Right now I'm climbing up Homestake Hill, or climbing up Homestake to east of Butte, so you probably hear my little Detroit under the hood, struggling up with a 75,000-pound truck to pull up the hill. So, anyways, well, I hope to see you out here in the homeland soon there, comrades. Stay safe, and watch out for those bullets that might be flying shortly because of the BLM trying to institute their kill whitey policy. I haven't been keeping up on the one going on down there in the LA area of 100 whiteys in 100 days thing. I'm not sure what the scorecard is on that one. I haven't seen anything other than the initial post that I made mention of earlier in an earlier little blurb. But anyway, all right, this is the trucker coming at you from Montana, enjoying my nice peaceful drive across unpopulated, nice, wide open, big sky country. Come on out here, enjoy it. It's nice. All right, this is the trucker signing off. Catch you later and see you out here soon, comrades.
They say, can you know? We've got a long way to go and a short time to get there. I'm westbound, just watch your bandit run.
Okay, we've got another parody song for you right now, but this one is much older than More Kyu or anything on YouTube. This is a parody jazz song that was actually broadcast on German radio during the war as part, I guess, of Axis Sally's efforts to demoralize the Allied troops or whatever. This is a parody of an old jazz song called Makin' Whoopee. None of us, of course, would recognize that today, but our grandparents would. Anyway, it's an interesting little historical curiosity, and it shows that, believe it or not, yes, the Nazis did actually have a sense of humor and satire.
USA have asked Eddie Cantor to write a new version of his famous all-timer Makin' Whoopee. In one of his latest programs on the air, he sang the following song. Another war, another prophet, another Jewish business trick, another season, another reason for making whoopee. A lot of dough, a lot of gold, the British Empire's being sold. We're in the money, thanks to Frankie, we're making whoopee. Washington is our ghetto, Roosevelt our king. Democracy is our motto, think what a war can bring. We throw our German names away, we are the kikes of USA. You are the boys, folks. We are the boys, folks. We're making whoopee. Thank you.
Not sure who did this. This might be more cue as well. It's just one of these things that people keep loading me up with off YouTube. And for obvious reasons, a lot of these YouTube performers don't want their real names attached to this stuff.
Agreeing with liberals for the wrong reasons, episode 6. Extended maternity leave, equal pay laws, and non-discrimination laws in general. Firstly, a traditionalist argument for maternity leave, or as close as I can get to one. Really, for a traditionalist, maternity leave is a lesser of two evils. It allows women to enjoy the fulfillment of having their own children instead of working for a capitalist until their ovaries and everything else shrivels up and dies.
Good shiksa. Give your entire life to my business.
Once given a taste of child-rearing, the women may be lured away from the oh-so-important cubicles and back to traditional roles. Thank you, maternity leave, you Trojan horse. This encourages population stability among the First World natives, which means one less argument for immigration. And yes, it is the First World natives whom are encouraged by this. I mean, with paid maternity leave, we're not talking about a McDonald's burger flipper job, are we? We're talking about white-collar workers, and these are precisely the people who are not having enough kids, relative to the lower socioeconomic classes. Whether you think intelligence is determined by heredity or environment, these people have both high intelligence, on average, and the means, the monetary means, to provide a good environment to their children. So either way, these are the people you want to breed. There are also economic incentives involved in female workers having higher costs attached to them. The risk of a sexual harassment lawsuit is a pretty big risk and cost, even bigger than months and months of paid maternity leave. I guess you could ask in the interview, are you planning to have kids? But not hiring them on the grounds of their reproductive ambitions would probably get you a discrimination lawsuit. So the economic incentive is to hire fewer women and more men, if these costs are high enough. Suddenly, the demands of feminists have put them back in the kitchen. The longer the maternity leave, the better for this cause. When combined with these protected class policies, equal pay legislation has the same effect. Think of what libertarians always say on this issue. If you can pay a group of people less money, you will hire more of them because it gives you a competitive advantage. Conversely, if they cost more, you hire fewer, or you reduce their wages to compensate for the non-wage costs of these workers. An equal pay law would prevent this wage adjustment, and employers would no longer be able to shoulder the extra cost of the protected classes. Back to the kitchen. Unless they're able to disperse the cost among their other employees who don't cost so much, which entails pay cuts for them. And I'll give you an example of this wage cut as a compensation for non-wage costs, okay? Your employer has to pay money into Social Security. Of the Social Security taxes, you pay half and your employer pays half. Now, given that the liberals we're agreeing with think capitalists are evil, greedy motherfuckers who will cut your wage just to get a little more profit, we can be almost certain that they agree with me when I say, your employer is taking those Social Security taxes out of what he would have paid you. His profits are not taking a hit. Then again, if Social Security taxes were abolished, he'd probably keep the half he wasn't giving you because, well, you're used to the shit pay. However, it's entirely possible that the extra non-wage costs of these workers would be spread over all the workers. And then this wouldn't account for a portion of a pay gap. Whether that happens is all up to the outcome of a battle between your male employees who don't want to take a pay cut so you can have more diversity, and your desire not to have a shitty public image. So if conservatives hate gays, women, trans people, and blacks, what they should do is try to increase the regulatory cost and risk of hiring those people. All in the name of tolerance and social justice, of course. If you make things social justice-y enough, those people will have a very hard time getting jobs, and it'll be just like returning to a society where we socially shame those people until they kill themselves. That's agreeing with liberals for the wrong reasons. But all of this falls apart if anybody decides to institute diversity quotas.
There's a man who leads a life of danger. Everyone he meets, he stares a stranger. Read every move he makes, another chance he takes. Odds are he won't live to see tomorrow. Secret agent man, secret agent man, they've given you a number and taken away your name.
No spectacular examples of fetish wrongdoing this week. I'm just going to have a quiet little chat with you guys. I recently got into an email exchange with a comrade about my Who Guards the Guardians feature that I sometimes podcast on here, and the guy wanted to know if I'd lost my mind baiting and insulting these admittedly very bad people who have guns and the legal power under the National Defense Authorization Act of 2011 to kill me. If they can get some higher-up to sign off on it, although exactly who in the federal government has the power to authorize a hit isn't quite clear. In the mob, it's usually the boss or the underboss, but in the American dictatorship, some say it's only Barry himself, and some that it's the U.S. Attorney General as well, and some say that it's something called quote-unquote competent federal authority, which basically means whatever the hell they want it to mean. Now, we know that beginning in 2011, an unspecified number of American citizens have been killed by the U.S. government outside the country. They admit that openly. The two people that we more or less know about so far who have been quote-unquote extrajudicially executed here in the United States are the journalist Michael Hastings in Los Angeles and that Chechen guy Ibrahim Todashev in Florida. They were executed in the summer of 2013, within about a month of one another. Hastings by a drone attack on his car, and Todashev was shot 7 times by an FBI agent while he lay on the floor of his apartment in Orlando. There may be other cases that we don't know about. Since we haven't been told any bona fide details about these cases, we kind of have to guess. But Hastings may have stumbled onto something in the course of a story that the Obama regime didn't want discussed in public, and Todashev appeared to know something about the Boston Baked Bomb incident that displeased the dictatorship, and they were scared he talked to somebody, maybe somebody like Hastings. I would say the okay for those hits probably came from the so-called Department of Justice, which would have the responsibility of carrying out these warrantless killings within the United States as opposed to the military. God, that name is getting positively Orwellian, isn't it? Department of Justice. Then the comrade that I was chatting with asked me something. He said, Harold, you know they listen to Radio Free Northwest. Have you ever tried just talking to them, seriously, man to man, and seeing if you can reach any of them? I know that FBI agents are pretty much a lost cause, but what about ordinary street cops? They can't be happy with all this Black Lives Matter crap, and now niggers are simply gunning them down on the street, like that deputy in Houston who was gassing up his car when a coon sneaks up behind him and shoots him in the back of the head. Actually, this has been suggested a few times in the past, but no, I've never attempted it. For one thing, they're not interested. To them, the people they destroy aren't human beings, they're simply assigned targets. Federal law enforcement in particular are like men who work in a slaughterhouse. They clock in at 8 in the morning, or whenever. They spend their day knocking cattle or pigs in the head with that compression gun thingy, killing them, hanging them by their legs from a hook, and sending them on down the line, and then at 5 o'clock they clock out, and they go home or to the bar or the strip club or wherever federal agents go at night, which I gather can be some pretty wild places if you're a Secret Service agent. But you get what I'm saying. Slaughtermen don't talk to the animals they butcher. Why should they? To federal law enforcement, people are just raw material to be processed so that they can get their direct deposit every 2 weeks. For another thing, having a real heart-to-heart talk with these people, even assuming it was possible, would involve my being very blunt about certain things that it's probably not a good idea for me to be candid about. I would have to say things out loud that we would both know perfectly well to be true, but given who they are and who's listening, that's the kind of thing that might end up getting played back at me in a courtroom someday, in view of the fact that these people are listening in for the specific purpose of doing harm to me and to you and to all of us, and to try and find some way to make me be quiet while still maintaining an outward appearance of respect for the Constitution and due process. Now, you know that old saying that the truth shall make you free? Actually, it's precisely the opposite. In Obama's America, the truth will more probably send you to prison. This society and the people who serve it have developed an almost frantic aversion to the truth, because the truth is a threat to the men and the women who draw the 3-figure salaries of taxpayers' money, who wear more on their backs to the office every day than an average white man or woman brings home every month, and who tell everybody else what to do, because, of course, they're just so much better than we are. The truth is that those men and women who rule us are a deadly combination of evil and stupid, or else they're just niggers. And that is a truth that they cannot bear to hear spoken aloud or to read in a book. Hence the banning of my own works of fiction from publication and sale almost 2 months ago. Someone became so frightened by what that kid in Charleston did and by the vision of the future that he made them look in the face that they felt they had to do something to silence my voice, lest it finally be heard in the land. It is a truth that they pay billions every year to law enforcement and the military to suppress, not to talk about. I repeat, butchers don't converse with the animals they slaughter, they simply kill. I've heard it said that federal law enforcement officers deliberately stifle their consciences or put them in a kind of a deep freeze, that they have to do that in order to function every day. I think the truth is much simpler and more horrible. They don't have one to begin with. No, seriously, take some young man or woman who's just starting their course at Quantico this fall to become an FBI agent at age, what, 24, 25? I checked their website just now and found that they do still require a college degree, which more and more now effectively shuts out white males other than the middle-class sons of the political and economic elite, probably connected with the ruling Democratic Party in some form or another, since working-class white boys more or less don't get to go to college anymore under the rule of political correctness. Melvin Purvis probably couldn't make it into the Bureau these days. Too white, too blue-collar, and he was probably a Republican. Anyway, let's say our hypothetical FBI recruit is a millennial, male or female, born in 1990. Where the hell is someone like that going to get a conscience, or any sense of morality or moral compass? No, serious question. I'm not saying it's impossible, but in that context, it's not bloody likely. Who's going to teach him? If this was a sufficiently middle-class family who was able to send a white boy to college beginning around 2009 or so, then it was a household with a working parent and step-parent, since by the time most white kids come along, there have usually been multiple marriages and one biological parent is absent. Now, within another generation, marriage of any kind will probably be gone, other than sodomitic domestic partnerships or whatever the regime decides to call them. Anyway, our millennial kid FBI trainee was probably raised at first by daycare and by assorted babysitters and nannies, and then by a television set and a computer at home until both parents staggered in at about 7 o'clock at night carrying takeout for supper, too tired to do anything except stumble to the bar for a vodka martini. Okay, I get that there are infinite possible variations on this story, but realistically, it's pretty much an even bet that the only ethics or ideology or morality that FBI recruit absorbed in his or her life came from an electronic screen, and we know who controls the electronic screens in this society, don't we? He or she did not learn ethics or morality in their childhood. They learned ideology, and there is a big difference. The ideology they learned was cultural Marxism, left-wing political correctness, and one of the main tenets of cultural Marxism, aside from such things as white males being satanic monsters who are the source of all evil in the world, is that there is no merit or legitimacy to any opposing point of view other than that of the Democratic Party, and that enemies of political correctness are not to be argued with or engaged in any way. They are to be destroyed through the use of the law and the prison system if possible, as in the Edgar Steele and Bill White cases, and otherwise now through cyber shaming on Twitter and Facebook and so-called economic discipline, which in the McCarthy days used to be known as the blacklist. The banning of my novels is an exercise in economic discipline, a.k.a. blacklisting. Okay, look, I'm starting to run long, and we need to get to third music break. Another thing I got this week by email was a communication from a guy in Missouri who, as near as I can figure, wanted to know when I was going to mount my white horse, draw my saber, and flourish it aloft, and lead the charge of this NVA army that everybody knows I'm hiding up in the North Woods here, and yet which I perversely refuse to let anybody see. I get... well, not a lot of that, but sometimes I do get it from people who genuinely appear to believe it, that I have some deep, dark, secret plan which I'm just not sharing with everyone because I'm such a meanie or whatever. Now, I've discussed this before, and I also have discussed one of the real-world historical sources of this kind of fantasy, the revolution we all dream about. The storming of the Bastille on July the 14th, 1789, by a revolutionary mob, incited by the writer and journalist Camille Desmoulins. Now, I won't go over that event again with you, but I will say this, that the French Revolution did not begin with the storming of the Bastille as such. The prisoners had almost all been moved in the previous weeks, and there were only 7 remaining to be liberated when the mob forced their way in and lynched the governor. No, the French Revolution began that day not when the fortress fell, but when the regiment of troops that the government called out to shoot down the mob refused to obey orders and either threw down their muskets and fraternized with the people, or else turned their guns on their own officers and shot them down, depending on which version of the story you believe. I have also previously discussed on here the history of the French national anthem, La Marseillaise, and so I won't go over that again. I will say that I like this song because it is a truly inspirational anthem of revolution, and because it gives me a vision of a guillotine with heads falling, heads that need to fall. I can't tell you which heads, because according to a federal judge in the Bill White case, you guys are an inherently criminal and violent audience. He knows you, you see. Every one of you, personally. And he knows how criminal and violent you are. Of course he does. He's a judge and he's Jewish, so he knows everything, right? Anyway, listen to this. Close your eyes. Think guillotine. And imagine your own personal list of heads falling. Great, isn't it?
Allons enfants de la patrie, le jour de gloire est arrivé. Contre nous de la tyrannie, l'étendard sanglant est levé. L'étendard sanglant est levé. Entendez-vous dans les campagnes mugir ces féroces soldats? Ils viennent jusque dans nos bras égorger nos fils, nos compagnes. Aux armes, citoyens, formez vos bataillons. Marchons, marchons. Défenseurs,
Now, I've been talking about federal agents, but ordinary street cops, white cops, and serving white members of the imperial military are a completely different kettle of fish. Some of them, anyway. I'm out of time now, so I can't get deeply into this, and I probably shouldn't get too deep into it anyway, but there is a saying that war is when you let the government tell you who the enemy is. Revolution is when you decide for yourself. On July the 14th, 1789, a pretty small number of French soldiers, probably no more than about 100 or so, decided for themselves who the enemy was, and they made history and shook the world. You white cops out there, I'm sure you're acutely aware that the regime you've been serving all your lives is hanging you out to dry now. Big fat negresses with buffalo butts are running on to platforms and screeching like gibbons at Democrat politicians, the ones with the actual power. And the Democratic Party has decided to nail you cops to the cross to stop the coons from rioting and to sew up nigger votes in 2016. Don't believe me? Look at the six cops in Baltimore who were indicted because a nigger scam artist tried to injure himself for a fake insurance claim, and he managed to crack his own spine, ramming his own head against a paddy wagon wall. The nigger female district attorney did not hesitate for a second to throw them to the wolves when she got rattled, not to mention the fact that you guys now go out on the street every day with a target painted on your back by Black Lives Matter. And you white military guys, the endless deployments, the incompetent affirmative action officers, many of whom get themselves and you and your buddies killed, the cheap equipment that doesn't work half the time, the choking bureaucracy, those black and brown comrades in arms of yours recruited from the gangs and the methadone line to fill a quota, the endless sense of drift, the complete lack of any overall game plan or strategy when Barry and the Democrats stick you over in the desert for months and years with no clue as to what the hell you're supposed to be doing there or where it all ends. This is what, the third time we've gone into Iraq in a little over 10 years? And all this while little brown men with towels around their heads and AK-47s snipe at you from behind every outhouse? At least Bush and his little Jewish friends had a plan, even if it was an insane plan. Now, getting back to that day in Paris so long ago, July the 14th, 1789, a day so important that an entire nation has a national anthem about it. I say again, that is when a revolution genuinely begins, when the hired muscle decides not to do as they're told and change sides. When the mercenaries decide not to stay bought and turn their weapons on the scumbags who have been paying them to do evil. This is why I talk so much on here about cops and FBI and white military men, because cops and muscle men of various kinds are absolutely central to the problem, and realistically they will probably determine the future of the white race, if indeed we have any future. Now, there's another date we need to remember, November the 20th, 2014. I know you think I'm obsessed with that date, but for real, on that day the long ailing Constitution of the United States died and we became a dictatorship. When Barack Hussein Obama arbitrarily changed the very nature of America and the useless Republicans in Congress who had a constitutional remedy available to them simply sat there like potted plants. Barack Hussein Obama rules this country without law and without legitimacy. The one rules, as he boasts, by the stroke of his pen. But in truth, he rules through those guns on the hips of all of you, police, soldiers, Marines, and other muscle men whom the ruling party and the bureaucracy in D.C. pays money to hurt people who dissent from their policies and protest against their actions. If Obama didn't have you and those guns on your hips and in your shoulder holsters, he wouldn't last a month. Because, like all tyrants, the American dictator rules through force and fear. In exchange for those direct deposits into your bank accounts every 2 weeks, you men provide him with both. It is you who make Obama possible. It is you who make all of this horror possible. So yeah, I'm going to talk about your ass. Anyway, our time is up for this week's edition of Radio Free Northwest. This program is brought to you by the Northwest Front, Post Office Box 4856, Seattle, Washington 98194. Or you can go to the party's website at www.northwestfront.org. This is Harold Covington, and I'll see you next week. Until then, Sasha Andaban. Freedom.